From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the Wolverine Watchmen indictments send the state back to its debate about guns in Lansing's halls of power.
There are more and more rallies beyond Open Carry Day. More and more times we've had people on the Capitol lawn in the gallery with guns, and it is of huge concern.
We'll be speaking with a member of the state's Capitol Commission. Also, a deep dive on how Michigan families are doing with online school.
I wrote an email to my daughter's counselors asking to drop half of her classes yesterday because she's feeling failure.
The unknown of like how long this is going to go on is definitely taking a toll on a lot of parents.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the program, we'll be checking in with parents about the mental and emotional strains of navigating this school year with children amid a pandemic.
Parents are, we're the car that drives our kids around to places. And if we don't have any fuel in our tank, then we're just sitting in the garage with our kids kind of upset and whining and wanting something to happen, but we don't have the means to get them anywhere.
But first, the plot by alleged domestic terrorists to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer also included plans to rally 200 armed men and women to storm Michigan State Capitol building and take hostages. The conspirators planned to use lethal force if necessary. Some of the men were seen a few months ago wearing AR-15 rifles on a legislative balcony hanging over lawmakers in the Capitol. All of this is a stark reminder that guns are allowed in Michigan's Capitol building, and that attempts to ban them thus far has failed. Joining us now is somebody who's thought about this from a couple of different perspectives. Joan Bauer is a former state lawmaker, and she now sits on the state's Capitol Commission, a nonpartisan group that oversees the Capitol building itself. Joan Bauer, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much, April.
Tell me, what was your reaction when you heard the revelation about the plot and the federal and state indictments yesterday?
I was, as I'm sure everyone was, shocked and horrified that things have come to this. Just absolutely horrified. When I heard, as things began to be reported more, that part of the plot was 200 armed men and women storming the Capitol, that made it even more real to me, especially as you said, I was a state representative, served in that chamber, and also now serve on the Capitol Commission.
You served in the state legislature, Joan, and will remember well the Second Amendment days at the Capitol when gun advocates would enter the House and Senate galleries with high-powered rifles strapped to their bodies. Can you tell us what that was like for you as a lawmaker sitting below them on the chamber floor?
The first time that I walked from my office building to the Capitol on Open Carry Day, I have to admit, April, I was shocked. I didn't realize in Michigan, even though I was a legislator, I did not realize that we allowed open carry in our state. I had to learn a great deal about our gun laws quickly. So I was very shocked and surprised that people were all over the Capitol lawn with their guns. But when I was there from 07 through 12, there might be 100 people there. And they mainly were on the Capitol lawn. They did come in. But it has just in the last year, particularly, there are more and more rallies beyond Open Carry Day. More and more times we've had people on the Capitol lawn in the gallery with guns, and it is of huge concern. And I have been worried sick about for months that we were going to have a terrible tragedy because we haven't acted. And hearing the most recent report just underscores the need for something to be done.
We are in a situation right now where the supporters of the Second Amendment are allowed to carry firearms in the building, and yet the rules do not allow for posters, people coming in to advocate for different causes can't hold up posters. Can you tell us about the stated reasons for why some gun supporters say that it's appropriate for them to continue to carry, even though we've got these other restrictions on certain forms of speech in the Capitol?
Well, I happen to think that it's an extreme position. I have talked to hundreds of people in the last few months, Republicans, Democrats, people from all parts of the state, just people I know who would say to me they were shocked and surprised that guns were allowed in the Capitol building. They had no idea. And I would say that a huge percentage of Michiganders think it is reasonable to have areas where we do not allow guns. We don't allow open carry everywhere. You know, there are restrictions, and that the Capitol should be one of those areas, the Capitol building particularly, where it's reasonable that you cannot carry a firearm into the building.
And you recently moved in a commission meeting to vote on whether to ban guns at the state's capital, and that proposal failed. Can you tell us about why?
Well, I made a motion that we, as the Capitol Commission, should ban. We had two motions, actually. The first one was that we would ban all firearms, which would be also concealed weapons. That did not pass our commission. That was defeated 4-2. Then a fellow commissioner presented the motion that we would ban open carry, which our state police feel would be something that they could enforce because it's visible. They could enforce immediately. And so Bill Candler made that motion, and that was a 3-3 vote. So we could not pass that either. And I will say, I do not speak for the commission. I'm speaking my own personal opinion as a commissioner, but the other commissioners, they feel that even though we have an opinion that we have the legal authority to ban guns, they feel that the legislature should really be the body that would ban weapons, guns from the Capitol.
Well, as a former lawmaker yourself, do you think that's the wise move?
I absolutely think that the legislature today or Monday should. There are bills in the legislature currently, I believe, that have been introduced in that process that would, you know, ban guns. I would hope and urge, now that these recent developments have occurred that come to light, that the leadership in the House and the Senate would feel that it's time for them to take that action to ban guns. I absolutely agree with the rest of my fellow commissioners. That would be really the best way to do this. It would be quick. It would be done legislatively. But I feel strongly that if that does not happen, and this has been my position for months, then the Capitol Commission we have the legal authority, and that we have the moral responsibility to take this action if the legislature won't do it. Again, my first preference would be that they go ahead, they pass a law that would ban guns. It would be done legislatively. But if that doesn't happen, I think it's time for the Capitol Commission to act.
Some might argue that the conspirators were not, in fact, able to muster 200 people to take over the Capitol building, that the FBI was able to apprehend this plot before it got to that point, and that the Capitol is the people's building and that guns should be allowed where the people are allowed. You, as a legislator, have represented gun owners. What is your message to those who think that, you know, the Second Amendment is the Second Amendment, end of story?
I do not think the Second Amendment is all-inclusive. The open carry legislation, concealed pistol legislation, we have gun regulations and laws in Michigan, and there are places where guns are restricted. And it's a little confusing because the legislation is different restrictions for concealed weapons, for open carry. So I think it's reasonable that there are places that guns should not be. And, you know, daycare centers, schools, capitals. And I think that's a reasonable position. And I would have shared that with any of my constituents.
Joan Bauer is a former Michigan state lawmaker, and she is a member of the state's Capitol Commission. Joan, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me, April.
Just one note, Stateside has reached out to legislative leaders Lee Chatfield and Mike Shirky to ask them to come on the show to talk about the issue of guns at the Capitol, and we will have them on if and when they'd like to join us. Since the news broke yesterday about the alleged plot, Michigan Radio's newsroom has been tracking down more information for you about the case. You can head over to michiganradio.org for developments today and through the weekend. You should know that a previously planned rally at the state's Capitol building went off as scheduled yesterday, just a few hours after the indictments were revealed. The event was organized by Stand Up Michigan. The group's self-proclaimed mission is to reclaim and defend the rights and liberties of citizens. Its members describe it as a faith-based organization. Many in the crowd carried pro-Trump signs. One of the speakers was Republican House Speaker Lee Chatfield, who called the alleged plot against Governor Whitmer unacceptable and un-American. Speaking on behalf of the Michigan Pastors Alliance, Chatfield's father, the Reverend Stanley Chatfield, called for Christianity to become, and I'm quoting here, the dominant force in our country again. After a short break, we're going to hear about some of the tough lessons that families have been learning about virtual schooling in the first few weeks of fall.
A lot of people have these piecemeal plans in place with the idea that they might be temporary, but we just don't know how temporary these plans really are.
What I'm seeing in parents and kind of kids and families as a whole is just increasing stress, like for everybody. So there's just more tension in homes, which can lead to more conflict.
Does this suggest that we should be doing things any differently? Stay with us. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're more than a month into the school year now, and things look a little bit different for every family. Some are doing virtual school, some are back in person, others have chosen to homeschool. But everyone is having to adjust to a new and often stressful reality. We spoke with several parents about what this has meant for their families. Let's listen to what they had to say.
I didn't cry today. Actually, wait, no, I did. So I have four children.
Back to the regular.
They're all doing virtual schooling. They're each in a different room.
I will be there in a second. I'm helping Madu.
And so I sit down to help my 6-year-old with something in a workbook. We start working on it, and then I hear Mommy from the other room.
I will be there in a minute.
And I'm like, okay, hold on, 6-year-old. I run in to that room, start helping her with trying to figure out her schedule and what class she's supposed to be in next. Then I hear my son in the other room screaming at the Chromebook, about to throw it across the room.
Yeah.
So I run in there and try to help him. Then I go back out of the room. Then I deal with a couple phone calls from work. And, you know, it's just like that all day long. And I feel like I'm kind of failing everyone.
My name is Lori Reinhout. I have two children. I have a 14-year-old daughter, Brianna, who started high school this year, and then a 12-year-old son, Brody, who is in 7th grade. So I work at Target, and I work the morning shift. So I usually start work at 5 or 6 in the morning, and then I'm usually out sometime between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., depending on how busy we are that week. And so the kids, other than my days off, the kids are basically getting themselves up in the morning and getting ready and getting logged on to school. I think it was a little bit scary for all of us at first, but they really rose to the occasion, and I was very impressed, because up to this point, it's been very hard to ever get them up for anything. I took the day off the very first day that they started, and then I worked the second day, and I was a wreck, but they were fine. They called me to let me know that they were not only up and getting ready to log in, but my daughter had made breakfast for my son. He wanted scrambled eggs and hash browns, and she made them all by herself, which was a big deal. And so, yeah, they're doing it, and I'm just really proud of them.
Okay, I am a single mother. Three girls. One is 16 and 11, a 6-year-old in first grade, and a 5-year-old in kindergarten. And we are all doing virtual school right now. I'm in the Farmington district. Oh, and I'm working full time. My job is not remote. I have to go in every day. The 6-year-old actually got kicked out. Was it yesterday? Yes, got kicked out of her meeting because it's hard to get her to sit down and pay attention. So she was unmuting, you know, she was being a kid. So she got kicked out of online school for a day. Yes.
Hey, is this Sari?
Yes, it is.
Hi, it's Jennifer from Michigan Radio. How are you doing?
Oh, my God. I just can't even. I am a teacher. I live in Ann Arbor. I'm a single parent. I have 3 children. I have a 16-year-old who is in Ann Arbor Public Schools, and she has an IEP, which means that she has some special learning considerations. She has fluency issues, so she learns very, very well if she's listening to a teacher or engaging in group work. She doesn't learn by reading. So she normally gets all A's with a couple B's, you know? I don't think she's ever gotten a B minus. If she passes her classes, I'll be grateful. I'll be honest. At this point, I just need her to pass these classes. And it's not her. She's not the problem. She's doing the best she can. She's emailing the people she needs to email. She's trying to figure out how to get her Chromebook to read things to her. You know, she is attending class. She's got her camera on. She's got her mic on. She's engaged. She's participating. She's doing her thing. But the thing is that if the school can't figure out how to read things to her, then she can't pass classes.
The voices of Sari Stetson, whose kids attend Ann Arbor Public Schools. We also heard Melanie Floyd of Farmington Hills. Lori Reinhout's children go to Warren Consolidated Schools, and Julia Kumbasa is in the Lincoln Consolidated District. Their stories came to us from Michigan Radio's reporter and executive producer of podcasts, Jennifer Guerra, and she's with us now. Jen.
Yes.
Wow. I mean, individually, nothing that was said is particularly shocking to anyone who parents or who has a parent in their life. But to hear it laid out like this, I mean, this is a lot.
It is a lot. Yeah. I think, I mean, if there was like a word to sort of sum up what I was hearing, it was exhaustion. I think exhaustion would sort of be the main one. And just how sustainable is this? Those were kind of the two things I would say that came up repeatedly. There were some parents who were like, you know, definitely seeing the positive. Everyone was trying to see the positive in what was going on with remote school. And a lot of people did talk about they get to see their kids more. And that's great. But the unknown of like how long this is going to go on, it's definitely taking a toll on a lot of parents.
What issues would you say were top of mind with the folks that you talked to? I mean, was it the issues about kids possibly falling behind academically or missing out on the social interaction that used to be a huge part of their day, or just how long online schooling can work out for them? What would you say was just really the front burner issues?
Can I say all of the above?
Yeah.
I feel like all of those came up. Interestingly, the academics, I don't think were necessarily top of mind with the folks that I talked to. So it definitely came up for some people. It was really the social emotional well-being of the kids that came up repeatedly. And really how long they can go on. A lot of parents that I talk to are going to run out of personal time that they're able to stay home with their kids because they have to go back outside of the home to work. How long they can rely on family members. You know, one grandma that I talked to was like, let's hope this only lasts one semester. And then it was like dot, dot, dot. And I know I was thinking, sure, you could hope that it lasts one semester, but we really don't know. And so a lot of people have these piecemeal plans in place with the idea that they might be temporary, but we just don't know how temporary these plans really are.
Let's bring Erin Hunter into this conversation. She's interim director of the University Center for the Child and Family at the University of Michigan. And her office provides counseling services for families, everything from therapy to assessment for learning disorders and neurodivergence. And Erin also has two kids who are doing school remotely at the moment. Erin Hunter, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Would you say that the demand for services that you and your staff have seen has gone up during all this?
We definitely are continuing to get calls, but I would say in some ways our call volume is lower than it typically would be for this period. And the way that I understand that is that I think that families are honestly so overwhelmed with all of the tasks that they're already doing that they probably want help and want to reach out for help, but they're actually just feeling so overwhelmed that it is harder to reach out.
Jen Guerra, I wanted to play a comment that came from a mom you spoke with, Caitlin Farrell. Is this right? You asked her about the toll that the school year has taken so far?
I think I just said, how are you doing?
Yeah.
It was just like a right. Pretty open-ended. I mean, we had been talking for a little bit, and I think I said, so how are you doing? Actually, I think I asked every single person I talked to, how are you doing? And it was just really telling people's reactions. And of course, I was catching them in a moment. But when I happened to talk to Caitlin, she was really feeling stressed.
Let's listen.
It's exhausting. I'm not going to lie. I've cried 3 times this week. It makes me feel horrible. It makes me feel like I'm failing my kid, like I'm failing myself and my husband. I mean, honestly, my mental health is suffering. It's taking a toll on my husband's ability to focus on his academics. Obviously, there's more pressure in our marriage.
So something about that clip that I do want to say, what we don't hear in that clip is she's saying that, you know, she's coming from a lot of privilege herself, but she has to work outside the home and her husband is in law school and taking an assistantship. And there are all these variabilities, as Erin has said earlier. Everybody's got their own unique situation. But the thing that really came up with her and what I'm seeing around when I talk to people is that there's a lot of comparison. She says she's looking on Facebook and seeing some parents are able to provide tutors for their kids or able to put their kid in a private school or able to stop working and help out more with school at home. And I think that is taking a big mental toll on parents, the comparison of what others are able to do and what maybe they are not able to do.
So obviously there's the feeling of being alone with all these problems, but also the feeling of being in a world that's dealing with it and maybe not measuring up to standards. Erin Hunter, what kinds of issues are you seeing cropping up with kids and parents? Does some of this ring true?
Definitely. And what the pandemic has done is make it harder for us to connect with our villages. So we're seeing things, but we're seeing it in 2D instead of 3D. You know, and I think that without knowing when it's going to end, that it is just an ongoing hardship. So I think what I'm seeing in parents and kind of kids and families as a whole is just increasing stress, like for everybody. So there's just more tension in homes, which can lead to more conflict. I think that sometimes people are trying to keep up and keep all their balls in the air, which is impossible. Some of them are going to drop at times, and especially during a pandemic and, you know, where we don't have the resources that we would have if we were not in this situation. So everyone has lower resources, but is trying to do more than what they would normally do. Even with kids, where they're trying to engage on a screen that they're not used to, and they can't look over and kind of get that social connection by making eye contact with their friends. You don't know if you're making eye contact with someone via Zoom.
Sure. Jen Guerra, it feels like parents aren't just being parents right now. What other roles did you hear them talk about stepping into?
All the roles. Snack maker and playmate and teacher, tutor, project manager. You know, they're just juggling. People are just juggling.
IT specialist. Yeah. That one's come up in our house.
Yeah, for sure.
For sure. For sure. Ours too. Yeah, for sure.
There's a lot there. Erin, so when we see these relationships between children and parents going through these somersaults and these new contortions, it seems like that cuts down even more of, you know, parents' ability to sort of stay centered in all this. Are there things that you're telling people about dealing with that?
Yes. And I think it's actually now more than ever, it's important for parents to do some things for themselves, even if it's just for 5 minutes, because parents are, we're the car that drives our kids around to places. And if we don't have any fuel in our tank, then we're just sitting in the garage with our kids kind of upset and whining and wanting something to happen, but we don't have the means to get them anywhere. So it is very crucial for parents to do things to take care of themselves, whether that's reaching out to a friend, whether it's reading a fiction book, whether it is standing outside and just letting yourself feel the sun on your face for a few minutes, giving yourself a moment to step into the bathroom, close the door, and take some slow, deep breaths for yourself. And the kids seeing parents kind of model that for them is actually really, really useful too. And even a parent saying, I'm really frustrated, I need to go take a break, I'm going to step outside for a few minutes and then I'll come back. Wouldn't that be lovely if kids were able to do that when they were upset instead of throwing something or yelling? The other thing that I would say that I really urge for everybody in this time, but particularly parents, is letting yourself be compassionate towards yourself. We are in a hard situation. There are no right answers. We are in kind of uncharted territory, and that is stressful and hard. So give yourself props for doing the best that you can in this crazy-making situation, lowering your expectations of yourself and your kids, and thinking about what are your priorities. So in your family, even like making a list of like, these are the things that are most important to our family. Those are the things we're going to focus on. And for now, anyway, we're going to let some of that other stuff go.
It seems like so much of this may vary and that the toolbox may have to be different depending on the age and maybe also the number of kids in the family. Jen, would you say that was, you know, that age and the ability of kids to, you know, do their own thing for a while was a big factor in how well parents felt like they were doing with all this?
Yeah, I do think age and ability are like two very key factors in terms of what it is like in the home. So if, you know, I have a first grader and a preschooler, so my homeschool thing is going to be very different than somebody that maybe has a seventh grader or a 12th grader. And it's going to be different from somebody who has a student with special needs. For a lot of parents that I talk to whose students do have special needs or have IEPs, they still haven't gotten the accommodations they need necessarily for their students. And so they're having to be the special ed teacher in addition to their work that they get a salary for at home, and in addition to whatever else they've got going on in the house.
Erin, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but parents in a lot of ways don't have control over what's going to happen. Maybe their kids will be back for face-to-face learning at some point. Maybe not. Maybe they'll go back to face-to-face learning and they'll have to resume online instruction at some point over the winter or spring. This uncertainty, what do you tell parents or kids about living in that limbo without just completely losing their mind?
It's a really good question, and I have to keep bringing myself back to this one as well as a parent. I think the biggest thing is reminding yourself of what is in your control and reminding yourself what is not in your control. What is in your control is your own behavior. And I want to highlight for parents, you can control your own behavior. You cannot control your child's behavior. But what we can do is we can do the things to take care of ourselves so we can step outside and feel that sun or just kind of have a breath of fresh air for a minute. The other thing that we can do is we can work to set up at least some bit of rhythm and structure in our own household to some sense of routine. And I think this is even more important when there is so much unpredictability, and especially for kids, is letting there be some things that are predictable. You know, in the morning, we're going to do these things. Our lunch is going to be this. Bedtime is going to be this. Here's part of our bedtime routine. That rhythm can do a lot to settle anxiety. And then kind of just acknowledging that, like, this is really hard and I can't control that right now. And sometimes I even imagine that there's a little bit of a waterfall. And I just imagine the waterfall coming and kind of washing away those things that I can't control and just watching them go down and then float away and drift off.
Erin Hunter is a clinical psychologist and interim director of the University Center for the Child and the Family at the University of Michigan. And we've also been talking with Michigan Radio's Jen Guerra. Erin, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much release it is, just myself hearing this, so I can only imagine how other parents might be benefiting from your work right now as well.
I'm happy to be here. This is a very important topic, so...
Yeah, when you were talking about living in limbo, I was like, I'm taking notes. Here's what I need to do.
Well, Erin, thank you. And Jen Guerra, please sit tight. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about what the options look like for parents who need backup. That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We know that a lot of kids in Michigan are doing school remotely right now, and some kids are just fine with it. But as we heard right before the break, there are plenty of families who feel perilously close to an edge at the moment. Michigan Radio's producer and editor, Jen Guerra, has been talking to parents through the opening weeks of the school year, and she's here with us. Hey, Jen.
Hello.
So if online school just isn't getting folks anywhere, what exactly are the options at this point?
Well, like pretty much everything with school right now, it depends on your scenario and it depends on the options that you have in front of you and really the options that are afforded to you. Something that came up time and again when I was interviewing people, what I really want to know is how single parents are doing it. That, I mean, almost to a T, everyone said that. So I wanted to talk to single parents to see how they are managing all the things at once. So one parent I talked to is, her name is MJ. And she has a fourth grader in a district that is doing, these are the options that this district is doing, in person 5 days a week, but it's a half day. So it starts early and ends by like 11:30 or online. Those are the two options. And this particular mother is an essential worker. She's a building maintenance person. And so she can't, you know, like fix a drinking fountain from her home. She has to be out of the home. She didn't really have a lot of options for her. She doesn't feel comfortable leaving her fourth grader at home by herself, and she wouldn't be able to pick her up for a half day of school. So I asked her, well, could you think about bringing a babysitter into your house to help watch your daughter? And here's what MJ said.
No, I can't afford that. You know, that's just going to be extra overtime that I'll have to work. But I mean, that's just something that you got to do. I don't want to lose everything I work hard for. I worked hard for this. Like, honestly, what world are we in? You should never have to juggle or choose your child's education or your job.
The other thing for MJ in particular, she had been in low-income housing for a very long time and had this dream for herself and for her kid to own a home. So she actually bought a home in May. So again, when we're talking about options, she now does not have the option to not work. She needs to pay that mortgage. You know, she's making it work. She's sending her kid to different family members' houses each day of the week. But she's really not sure how long she'll be able to maintain that.
I do find myself wondering also about families in which there are two parents, both of whom work and both of whom really have to be outside the home. Did you run into anybody like that?
Yeah, definitely. Alita Martin, she and her husband, they both live in Detroit and they both work outside the home. He manages some group homes and Alita runs a Head Start center in the city. And so she actually had been home since March. She's got a 12th grader, a 7th grader and a 3rd grader. This week was her first week back at work. And so she actually did some trial runs because she had to figure out, like, how am I going to leave my kids at home and do virtual schooling?
I would leave and just go somewhere for a few hours just to see where I'm seeing the most issues at. My youngest daughter really had the most issues this week, but I noticed by the end of the week and me reiterating to her that mommy has to go back to work and I really need you to get this together. By Friday, she seemed to have, I'm not going to say down pack, but she probably was about 50% better.
So we've been hearing the voices of a lot of moms. And I just want to mention again, there are plenty of dads out there who are right in the middle of this. But it certainly seems like a great deal of the work is falling onto women's shoulders.
Yeah, I would agree with that in terms of at least the people I talk to. One mother I spoke to, Melissa Clare, she and her husband actually, they have the same job. They work for Consumers Energy and they fix gas leaks. They've got 4 kids, 3 in high school, and then a little one. They've got a kindergartner. And they felt good about the high schoolers being able to do their own thing, but the kindergartner did need somebody at home. But Melissa and her husband both work during the day outside the home. So Melissa says she went into mommy mode and switched her schedule. She starts work now at 3:30 in the afternoon and goes till midnight, sometimes much later.
Last week, there were nights I was out till 3 o'clock in the morning. So I would come home and go right to bed. And then I was back up at 7 o'clock in the morning to wake Sloan up and start getting her ready for her day to begin. I don't feel like Sloan is doing well at all. I don't feel like she is focused. I don't feel like she's retaining information. I don't know if it's just her. I mean, the school district seems like the program they're offering is good, but it's not for my kid at all.
It kind of sounds, Jen, like Melissa's concerns aren't just academic, that she, like some other parents, are concerned about kids' social and emotional well-being.
Mm-hmm. And the social emotional component of remote school is a big one for many of the parents I talk to. So one mother I talked to, Caitlin Lynch, she is sort of working with the parents on her street. So it's a sort of a neighborhood pod. In Caitlin's case, her son has ADHD and Tourette's. So she said it can be quite challenging for him. And so if you're asking how does it work, I think it's still, at least in Caitlin's case, just too early to say how it's going to work.
I mean, I am 100% sure this is not the best thing for him, but under the circumstances, I think we can make it work. I don't know. It's ask me again in a couple of weeks if this is sustainable. I don't know.
Jen, thank you so much for sharing what you heard from all these parents.
Thank you.
Michigan Radio senior producer Jen Guerra. So where do we go from here? There's just so much fear and emotional noise in parents and kids' heads right now. I want us to listen to a comment from Camila Henderson, one of the parents that Jen Guerra spoke with. Her daughter has the option of face-to-face learning, and their family took it.
Every time we drop her off at school, I say a prayer. My husband says a prayer. We pray throughout the day for her safety and her classmates' safety and the teachers who are making such an enormous sacrifice for our children. So absolutely, our minds are not free and clear right now.
No matter what options families are going with, there are plenty of pitfalls. We wanted to finish up by going back to one of the parents that you heard earlier in the hour. Sari Koster-Stetson teaches at a small school district in Oakland County, and she's got family concerns in this too. She's raising 3 kids, ages 5, 16, and she has a 21-year-old as well. Sari, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
So the district that you work for has you teaching virtually this semester. Will you tell us a little bit about what you've observed emotionally of the kids in your class?
Well, when you say that we're teaching virtually for the semester, one thing to remember is that school districts are required to reassess their learning plan every 30 days. And so there's always the chance that a district that is teaching virtually might decide to teach in some sort of a hybrid situation or teach fully face-to-face all students all days. And we actually don't know how long we're going to be teaching virtually. And so that adds a added layer of stress for both teachers and students and parents. We were discussing in our staff meeting the other day that we finally feel like we've hit a flow. We finally feel like we know what we're doing. The kids know what we're doing. We've managed to figure out this technology. And then all of a sudden we might say in 2 weeks, you're in the building. So you asked about how students are doing emotionally. One thing that teachers and parents know is that consistency is really the best thing for kids. They need to have consistent expectations. They need to know what their day is going to look like. They need to know what their expectations are going to be, both at home and in school. And anytime you have a school that is switching back and forth from virtual to in person, you're making kids start over again. So in terms of my students, they need and they crave connection. I teach middle schoolers. Anybody who has a middle schooler or has seen a middle schooler knows that essentially I have 30 puppies in my classroom that all want to talk at the same time and cuddle at the same time and need attention at the same time. And they have the attention span of puppies, so they're all going in 30 different directions at the same time. And desperately what they need is consistency, and they need connection. They need to be connected to me as a caring adult in their lives, a stable caring adult. They need to be connected to each other desperately. That is one of the primary goals of middle school, is to develop your own sense of self. And the way that middle schoolers do that developmentally is they move away from their parents and they move towards their peers, and they try on different identities and they bounce them off their peers. And that's how they start to develop who they are as individuals. And so they need their peer group for that developmental process. Most middle schoolers will tell you that their favorite subjects are lunch in the hallway, right? for them, academics are really secondary. My district in particular has a lot of students that deal with difficult home environments. There's a good amount of poverty. There's some drug and alcohol issues. We have a higher than average amount of homeless students. We have students that are living with family members, extended family members. And so for them, school is their consistent, safe place.
There are metrics for what kids are supposed to learn during a regular school year. I just wondered how that, or if that is changing for you this year. I mean, and just where you consider the goalpost to be. I mean, is this a lost year?
It's not a lost year if what we do is reframe what our goals are. So you mentioned the goalposts. So in a traditional school year, you look at standards. Michigan has standards for every single grade, every single subject, right? Specific things that kids are supposed to be able to do at the end of the year. And if that's how we want to look at this school year, then it's going to be a lost year, because kids are not going to be able to achieve those standards. But I think that if we reframe our goal, I'm still teaching to my standards because that's the expectation that my school district has. But my goal in my classroom is to meet kids' emotional needs. And I think that that needs to be a larger goal. I think that needs to be a district goal, a state goal, and even a national goal. If we take academics off the table, and we all realize that just because you're supposed to learn long division in a particular school year and you don't learn it, doesn't mean you're never going to learn it. And we decide that academics are not going to be our primary focus. We can then focus on the things that kids really need right now. And what kids really need right now is connection. They need to have their emotional needs taken care of. There are safety concerns, of course, kids staying at home in unsafe situations. So there's some safety concerns. Teachers are already social workers. So when I walk into my classroom in a normal school year, I have children that are hungry and I feed them. I have children that need clothing and we get them clothing. We have children that need places to live and we figure that out. And so teachers are very, very good at meeting the emotional needs of students. So in my classrooms, I'm giving students a lot of time to connect. So if I would normally give an assignment that takes one class period, I'm giving them closer to four or five, and I'm letting them go to breakout rooms, and I'm letting them talk about video games and anime and their pets and what they're doing over the weekend. And I'm letting them have those connections with each other, because I'll be really honest, if they come to my classroom next year, I can reteach anything that I tried to teach this year. But the one thing I can't do is I can't take a bunch of isolated, traumatized kids and teach them, because then you're dealing with trauma. So I think that what we need to do is we need to realize that just like adults talk about the fact that we're getting, that we don't have the connections with friends that we used to have. Adults talk about the fact that we're getting Zoom fatigue. We can't sit on a Zoom meeting for 8 hours a day. So we can't expect our kids to be able to do that also. we need to take away some of that stress from kids. And I think that the way we do that is we don't call this a lost year necessarily. We reframe the focus of the year.
You know, we've heard in the past half an hour a lot about feelings of failure that parents are going through right now. And I think that just a lot of people, whether or not they have kids, are dealing with. Have you been able to push back against those feelings?
I can tell you that I wrote an email to my daughter's counselors asking to drop half of her classes yesterday because she's feeling failure. She's in a, we live in Ann Arbor. She's in the Ann Arbor School District. We have, I don't know, 6 computers in our house. She has her very own study area. We are very fortunate in terms of her access to technology, and she has a teacher, right? Downstairs, so I can sit with her and I understand what she's doing and I can help her. And she and I still feel like we're failing. So I'm 100% sure that pretty much every single parent right now feels like a failure. And if we feel like failures, then the kids feel like failures. And that's what we need to really think about. Because I was talking to my kindergarten, my son's young fives teacher. We had a parent teacher conference the other day. And she asked what my goals were. And my goal for him is I want him to feel like he is a learner. I want him to feel like he has the capability to learn. And if we put kids, no matter what age, high schoolers, middle schoolers, even my college age daughter, if we put them in situations in which they are failing through no fault of their own, then we are basically robbing them of their ability to see themselves as capable people who are able to learn in the future. What I'm doing with parents is when parents email me and they're having technology issues, they can't figure out how to add anything to Google Classroom, they don't know how to use the computer, this isn't in their skill set, I'm excusing projects, I'm taking projects late, I'm trying to get all of the barriers out of the way. And unfortunately, most of those barriers end up being academic. So if I have kids that come to my Zoom and they connect with me and I hear stories about their lives and I see pictures, you know, I see their dogs or their cats and they're connecting with other kids and I excuse them from every single project this semester, I'm going to call that a success.
Sari Koster-Stetson, coming to us from Oakland County. Sari, I know you've got so much on your plate right now. Thank you for everything you're doing, and thanks for taking a couple of minutes to talk to us.
No problem. I appreciate it. Thank you.
As Sari just reminded us, this is a conversation about kids and their experiences as well. We wanted to wrap up the show today with their voices and hear how they're doing.
My name is Miles, and I am in second grade.
Like going to school virtually better than you like going to in-person school?
No. It's so worse.
But you said you like it.
I like it, but I don't love it.
My name is Ella, and I'm in sixth grade. I'm doing virtual school. I think it's fine. It's just stressful for me, but it gets better.
My name is Sawyer.
And my name is Skylar.
What did you think about your first couple weeks of school?
They were pretty weird because we had to wear a mask, and I didn't really like it.
I didn't care because I usually forget it's on me.
Hi, my name is Millie, and I just started first grade, and I'm doing online school. Overall, I would give school a thumbs sideways.
Not a thumbs up or thumbs down?
It's not really great, and it's not really boring.
Like a so-so?
Yeah, so-so. The bad thing about school, this is like the one bad thing. I don't get to see my friends and I have to wake up so early.
Hi, my name is Michael Geis and I'm in the ninth grade. I'm doing virtual for the first semester. I personally like it because I get to work from home and it's in a more comfortable state.
Hi, my name's Olivia. I am in fourth grade. My classroom looks really different because it's like my house. I have a question for you.
Yes.
Do you think that we will get to do Halloween stuff?
I hope so. It's one of my favorite days of the year.
Well, too bad grown-ups can't go trick-or-treating. That's one sad part.
Yeah. I love you, babe.
Love you too, Mom.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks to those kids and their parents who shared their thoughts with us from all across the state. And that's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. Try to get some rest this weekend. We'll catch you next week.